things. Maybe not as serendipitous as that, but yeah. those types of things pop up on deals all the time, where something you'll kind of pull on a thread somewhere, and you kind of have to follow it all the way through to the conclusion.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a really cool story. One more.
Hi, welcome to the Fieldwork Podcast, a show where continuing legal education is delivered through conversations about law and business. This episode, our host, Gavin Johnson, will be interviewing Steve McKay on due diligence and business acquisitions. Steven is a business and finance attorney at Carr Tuttle in Seattle, Washington. So from the office on Canal Street, this is the Fieldwork.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Steve. This is our second conversation about business acquisitions. In our first conversation, we focused on considerations when drafting the deal documents. We're doing this a little backwards. We're now going to go back in time and talk about largely buyer-side considerations in due diligence. So we're going to go through due diligence through business acquisitions. We're just going to launch right in. I'm curious, what's your first step with a client? So a client's come to you, has already found a target company, and says, Steve, what do we do?
Yeah, so it sort of depends on kind of where in that process they actually are. So if they've identified a target, but they don't have them under a letter of intent, they don't have a term sheet signed, then we end up doing a lot more just kind of strategizing with that client, talking about structures and how we might actually put the acquisition together to sort of maximize tax efficiency and do some other things. Oftentimes, though, we'll have a client show up with an LOI in hand. Our first touch point with them will be sort of, here's a signed LOI. We're ready to kind of get going on diligence. And so in those latter cases, we're going to just kind of oftentimes, you know, provide them with a diligence checklist right off the bat.
Sure. Do you have clients that come to you that don't have a target company yet? So they basically come and they say, hey, we're looking to acquire companies. Here's what we're looking for. Do you ever assist with that process?
Yeah, every now and then we'll work with someone that maybe has, they're kind of like a private equity type firm, mm-hmm. and they've got a platform and they want to do add-ons, and they may be working with an investment banker that we know. And so we'll kind of help them. And mostly in those circumstances, the engagement largely deals with helping them work on LOIs once they've sort of found targets, or making introductions to them to investment bankers that we've worked with who do buy-side engagements. But yeah, that's relatively uncommon, at least in the Seattle market for us.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we talked a while back about the concept of search funds.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think that kind of falls into a
subcategory. Yeah, they're sort of a subcategory of buyer, and we've definitely worked with a number of search funds. And so when we're working with a search fund and kind of actually helping them set up, the way a search fund works is it's usually someone that's gone to your Harvard Business School or Penn or something like that. And rather than go work for an established company, they kind of create this vehicle where they've got some investors that give them some seed money to go find a business to acquire, with the idea being that they, you know, having come out of this top-notch business school, will be able to kind of find a business that is really a good business but needs some better management, or needs some sort of management with maybe different skill sets. And so they'll spend a period of time, you know, maybe a year, 18 months, scouring the country for the kind of ideal company for them to buy. And so when we work with those clients, there's sort of two steps to that. The first step is just creating the actual investment vehicle where the searchers can come in and raise a little bit of money. And they'll kind of work with some investors to put in, you know, maybe $500 to $1 million that'll kind of give them the funds they need to conduct the search. And then the second step is, once they've actually found that company, gotten it under LOI, then it's just a sort of more typical buy-side engagement. The benefit to those investors that work in that, put the money up front, is that they get sort of a credit for that money that they put in, and usually it kind of has like a, you know, 1.5x type return when it gets plugged into the equity in the actual acquisition.
Yeah, some sort of sweetener on there. So getting back, you'd mentioned something about a due diligence checklist. I wanted to dive into that a little bit. You obviously have some sort of due diligence checklist,
yeah.
is there anything else that's helpful in referencing when you're diving into due diligence?
So we've got kind of two different checklists. One is sort of a more, I don't know, friendly checklist in that it's not super intimidating when you open it up. It's in Word, and it's kind of, you know, it's designed, these checklists are really designed to be very broad. You want to create a record of having asked the question, and you know, the idea is you're going to have, you know, buckets for every single type of category of diligence you could imagine. And our sort of more standard checklist is a little bit kind of less tedious in terms of drilling down into every single subcategory. And it's in Word. And then the second one we have is for, you know, really, you know, serious acquisitions where we know diligence is going to be really, really important. It's an Excel doc, and there's kind of tracking built into it, and the ability to kind of, you know, do progress reporting. And it usually, we use that when we've got a data room that it's kind of keyed to.
Are you, with these checklists, are these mostly internal that are kind of your eyes only, or are these things you're sharing with clients too?
No, so we'll provide it to the client, and the client will typically hand it over to, you know, if there's an investment banker or the target itself. So the client will provide it to them and say, hey, here's the list of everything we want you to provide. Put this stuff into a data room. We usually tell our clients to tell the target or the investment banker, although they're pretty savvy and usually know, hey, you know, this list is intended to be overly broad. We know there's some stuff on here that isn't going to be applicable. We just want to be able to, again, ask the question.
Sure.
Because, you know, you could have a company, maybe that's in financial services or something, that you think has no environmental, you know, issues at all. And if you tried to sort of edit your checklist to get rid of that, and you find out for whatever reason this company maybe is storing a ton of, you know, toner or something.
Sure.
You know, and you wouldn't know about that.
Yep.
And they had a spill or something crazy
they
like that.
They threw their batteries in the wrong garbage can.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to be able to kind of ask the question with your due diligence checklist.
Yeah, cool. What are some of the common places you and other attorneys in general that are working on these deals are spending most of the time in due diligence, if there's a few places that you're spending most of your time from deal to deal?
Yeah, well, so every deal is kind of unique. And so the areas you're really focused on are going to be a function of what industry that target operates in. And then in every deal, there's sort of some stuff you're going to be looking for kind of no matter what. So, you know, third-party consents is a key issue. You want to be looking at if the transaction, the way you've structured it, is going to give some third party the right to sort of approve the transfer of their agreement to you as the buyer. You certainly want to know about those. And in an asset deal, that's kind of consent to assignment provisions. In a stock deal, you're looking for change of control provisions. But really kind of anything in agreements that are going to be implicated by the way you've structured your transaction, you want to know about. You know, sneaky way some people draft those things is they don't say anything about consent to assignment or consent to change of control. But in the termination section, they'll say that the counterparty has a unilateral right to terminate when and if there is a change of control or an assignment of the agreement.
Right. So in those situations, you've got some key contract in place and you don't need consent to transfer, but there's the risk that it's canceled or terminated.
Yeah, so effectively what you have to go in is, you know, instead of approaching them and saying, hey, we'd like your consent to transfer this, you say, hey, we want you to waive this provision.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there a typical order in due diligence with your practice? So, you know, for example, do you always start with legal versus financial?
So on buy side work, when we're working with folks, they're almost always... unless they've got really limited exclusivity, they're almost always going to want to do financial diligence first.
Do the numbers add up?
Yeah, they're going to want to make sure that sort of the way that they've envisioned the deal working and kind of penciling actually works. So they're going to usually engage a CPA firm to do a quality of earnings report. And usually we won't really get into legal due diligence until we've at least gotten a draft quality of earnings report back. And so, you know, if you're looking at kind of a Gantt chart, a timeline, you know, you might spend the first 2 to 3 weeks post LOI doing financial due diligence. And then, you know, 3 weeks in, legal due diligence might kick off.
Are you usually copied throughout that process in the financial due diligence?
Yeah, for sure. So we often will kind of work with the client and work with the accounting team. You know, we think of deals as team sports.
Sure.
And we're a member of the team. And so we're always kind of involved in that, and we'll usually get a draft of the quality of earnings report and some sort of early kind of insights into what the accounts are uncovering, because a lot of this stuff, even if it is just kind of numbers, informs some of the legal due diligence we're going to end up doing.
Yeah. Do you what's the, I assume there's some sort of line drawn in your role during that financial due diligence of being copied and kept up to speed. And how often are you weighing in there where something doesn't add up, or maybe an accountant says something that you're like, ah, but consider this, you know, like, is there other situations where you're piping up and saying, hey guys, I think we might've missed this in the numbers. Yeah.
Well, so oftentimes these reports will essentially identify issues or identify things that, you know, may be risks. And then it's sometimes a legal question of whether this company, you know, for instance, has nexus in a particular state.
Yeah.
And the accountant might just say, hey, these guys aren't paying taxes here. And the target's probably taking the position that they don't need to. And then we kind of get called in to say, well, you know, based on this state's nexus rules, you do or don't kind of have an issue here.
Sure.
As you operate the business after the closing.
Yeah, yeah. So back to what you said about the team sport is it's largely a team sport type of situation.
For sure.
So transitioning into legal due diligence, which I assume comes next in the process. You've gone through financials, the numbers make sense. When you're launching into legal due diligence, is there one particular place or a few places with, you know, quote unquote legal due diligence that you're spending most of your time?
Yeah, again, it's really just going to be a function of what the industry the target is operating in. So for instance, if we're working with a company that, you know, is a SaaS company and basically a software developer,
yep,
we're really going to be a lot more focused on IP naturally. We're going to want to make sure that all of their registered IP is actually in their name. We're going to want to make sure that the employees who actually created the intellectual property that the company purports to own have assigned it, and that they've got confidentiality provisions, and maybe if they're really key folks, that they've got non-competition provisions so that they can't post-acquisition just go work for a major competitor. And so we'll be a lot more focused on intellectual property for a company like that than we would be, you know, for a company that is more of a maybe, you know, like contractor or something.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
they're going to have maybe some limited IP, might have, you know, some trademark, but by and large they're going to have more traditional employment type issues and labor type issues, and we're going to be focused on, you know, maybe I-9 compliance and making sure that everyone that they've hired has, you know, submitted the proper paperwork and that you know, they're complying with wage and hours laws, and that they've got sort of arbitration provisions in place for their employees so they're not going to be subject to class action lawsuits.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The I-9 thing, I've heard some wild war stories about like I-9 raids and companies,
yeah,
companies that were unaware, and it wasn't that there was any sort of like bad faith,
sure,
thing going,
yeah,
on.
Yeah, no, it's an issue du jour, so to speak. I mean, there are definitely some of these hot button issues, and
yeah,
I-9 is one of them, and it just seems like in the last 5 to 10 years maybe, it's really gotten more and more of an issue, where that's just been a focus. And so, you know, you're exactly right. It may not even be an issue where someone's hiring folks who are not able to work here. It's just that they don't have the proper paperwork,
yeah,
where on the date of hire, they submitted the right form and they don't have copies of it. And so you can still get sort of in trouble for not doing that.
Yeah.
So that's definitely something where you've got, you know, a large workforce, or a workforce that turns over a lot, that you end up looking at on the buy-side diligence a fair amount.
Yeah, and just so listeners are aware, when we're throwing out I-9, it's basically, I mean, if anyone's unaware of this out there, it's a form that employees sign that say that they have the right to work here in the U.S., right?
Yeah, companies. You're supplying basically a social security number and certifying that you legally have the right to work in the U.S.
Right, yeah. moving a little bit of a different, to a different place, how often are your clients hiring business brokers for these deals? And is that usually happening prior to due diligence? I assume they're helping them,
yeah,
find the target company, right?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on this just a little bit right off the top, but we don't end up working very frequently with investment bankers that are having, you know, engaged to do buy-side work. Where we see it, it's, again, you know, private equity company that has a platform investment that they want to go find add-ons for. So, you know, if we have a company that is a steel fabrication business based out of Texas, and they're PE owned effectively, and they've been looking to do some add-ons.
Yeah.
And because it's sort of taken them a long time to kind of find those on their own, they naturally may go hire an investment banker to do a buy-side engagement and try to go find some steel fabrication businesses that they could add to their business, acquire them, and sort of achieve some inorganic growth in their bottom line.
Got it. Talking a little bit more about financial due diligence, and I'm kind of skipping back to that, but I'm curious with tax issues that come up, because tax issues can be pretty significant depending on the situation. In those scenarios where you've identified, and I guess this can be even broader than just tax issues, during due diligence, you've identified a problem, a red flag, something that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of like when you're going and buying a house and you've identified a few problem areas and you go back to the seller and you say, hey, on inspection, I found these things. You need to fix these.
Sure.
Or it can be some reduction in purchase price and I'll fix them myself. Like, what is a typical scenario?
I mean, there's all
there?
Sorts of different ways to kind of address those things. But invariably, you know, one thing or another will come up in due diligence. And the question is naturally, how do you address this?
Right.
Most of the time, I think the solution ends up being getting a line item indemnity in the purchase agreement. And by that, I mean, essentially, you know, we know that there is this issue X out there. If X pops up and bites us post-closing, you guys are on the hook for it. Dollar one, sometimes uncapped exposure. Other ways to address it is to put in place, you know, a specific escrow that will sit around and be a source of recovery for the buyer if this issue pops up post-closing. And maybe you've got kind of 12 to 18 months where you're able to do it. And then repricing is just another way where essentially you say, look, this is a cost structure item. It's now going to cost us an extra $100,000 every year to operate this business. We bid on your company, you know, assuming a 5x multiple of EBITDA. So this is really a $500,000 purchase price reduction that
right.
we need to see, because now going forward, we're going to have to comply with this. You see that sometimes with these SALT issues, state and local tax, where a company, you know, maybe based in Washington has, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, a more recent place where we've seen this. We had a company that did installation of sort of kind of convention booths.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
sure.
you go to a convention and they've got these really awesome fancy booths.
Right, like kiosks almost.
Exactly. And we had a client that sort of built those. And most of their sales were just direct sales of the parts. They'd sort of ship things and then someone else would assemble it wherever the convention was.
Yep.
But every now and then they'd sort of send their employees out to assist with the you know, set up and building and
right.
construction of the actual kiosk at the convention. And this was actually a sell side engagement we were involved in. And the buyer ended up, and its accountants and its legal team thought, well, you really should have been paying employment tax and some sales tax on those sales where you sent folks over to these various states. And that's going to cost us, you know, X going forward. And we had to stick a relatively sizable escrow in place for that deal to be able to kind of massage the issue.
On most of these deals, are you only, or I'll phrase it a different way, are you setting aside money in escrow, ideally, on the buyer side, to address things that come up that maybe were overlooked in due diligence, or you know, like salt issues, for example? You know, you can dig in as much as you can, but there might be things that you were unaware of that come up. Is it
sure.
typical to set money aside to deal with those situations that come up?
Yeah, I mean, again, and we talked about this a little bit in the last conversation, these purchase agreements are sort of like an insurance contract.
Yep.
And so, you know, you've got a bunch of coverage items, and the expectation is that these are all going to be good, valid reps. There's not going to be any breaches. But when and if there are breaches from things that nobody knew about, you want to have a source of recovery as the buyer. And so having money in escrow is a great way to do it. Having sort of a holdback of a purchase price is another one. And then you haven't even had to part with the money at closing. Being able to offset against any kind of seller paper. You know, these are all ways to sort of address and recover when and if something that maybe slipped through diligence pops up post-closing.
Yeah, so it's your insurance. You're insuring against those situations.
Yeah, sort of the risk of the unknown.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, it's Kyle.
And Gavin.
From the Fieldwork Podcast. This is your reminder that you can get CLE credits just for listening.
After the episode, go to yourfieldguide.com to get your CLE credits.
And to convince those in charge that you actually listened, you'll need this secret code.
Sneaky.
Sneaky. When was the last time you were sneaky?
Can't disclose. Sneaky.
Yikes, like old Saint Nick. Okay, Sneaky. Got it. And now, back to the episode.
So I'm going to transition away from legal, away from financial due diligence. We're going to talk a little bit about operational issues
that
come up. So we touched a little bit on employee labor-related issues. I'm curious, how well are you getting to know the seller company, the target company, in terms of what their products are, what their services are, what operations look like? How much do you dig into that during due diligence? I assume your client's digging into that a lot, but... Yeah. But I, in putting together the documents, you probably need to know a little bit about the business, right?
Yeah, for sure. And that's one of the things that, for me at least, makes doing M&A work refreshing, is that every company is different, and therefore every deal is different.
Yep.
And so you really do need to learn as much as you can about the target business, especially kind of how it operates financially. You know, if it's a product business, who its customers are, how it manufactures its products, where it gets them from, where it's selling them to. You know, all these things, because, you know, in sort of analyzing the business, it's going to sort of let you think more about what legal issues might pop up.
Yeah.
You know, you're obviously not going to have products liability necessarily in a business that doesn't have a physical product.
Sure. That makes sense.
There's going to be, you know, some things that just are inherent in the kind of business that your client is buying that are going to, you know, mold the direction and guide the direction you're doing in due diligence. And affect the documents you're going to write at the end of the day.
Do you end up down some pretty deep Wikipedia rabbit holes when it comes to like widget A manufacturing?
I just recently had a really interesting deal where we've got a client that is buying a furniture manufacturing company.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was on their website. And because my wife is an architect, I happen to know that there's this really, and she took this class in grad school where they got to design their own piece of furniture. And so one of the things that they did in that class was to sort of study all these other famous pieces of furniture.
Yeah.
And so I'm on this company's website and I see, you know, this chair that is, I know just randomly,
yeah,
a very famous chair. And I was like, you know, we got maybe a trade dress issue.
Yeah.
And we ended up having to get really, really deep into the, you know, that was not a design that they, did themselves. They were licensing it from another party. And then we were looking at how did the other party get the rights to this, and then we ended up bringing in an IP litigator to say, you know, is this chair similar enough to this famous chair,
right,
for there to be a liability? And at the end of the day, you know, we ended up basically deciding that because this chair's like base had fewer spokes on it than the famous chair, that maybe, you know, there wasn't necessarily exposure here.
This sounds so much like a law school.
Yeah, you just get really into the, you know, and those types of things, maybe not as serendipitous as that, but
yeah,
those types of things pop up on deals all the time, where something you'll kind of pull on a thread somewhere and you kind of have to follow it all the way through to the conclusion.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a really cool story, and one where you had to have felt good about the value you brought in that situation, which was like super random and serendipitous, like you said, but
yeah,
that's cool.
It you know, at the end of the day, we spent a lot of time and then ultimately deciding there wasn't liability, but it would have been a lot worse than, you know, if no one even had thought about it. And then, you know, the owner of that chair, who still is very litigious, the furniture company, that's sort of what made us end up spending more time on this. They're very litigious and really protective of that design. If they had of, you know, immediately after a client bought this, showed up and said, hey, stop selling this chair, which is, you know, a key component of this new product line you're trying to sell.
Right. Yeah. Are there, on operational issues, are there common issues you see when investigating target companies with existing operations, information about employees, beyond just, hey, do they have their ducks in a row from, you know, an I-9 form standpoint? Do they have all their I-9 signed? Is there something in addition to that, that's a common issue that comes up in evaluating like operational issues with these companies?
In with respect to employment, I really briefly touched on this earlier. Another issue that people have really started focusing on from the employer side of things is trying to make sure that their workforce is covered by agreements to arbitrate disputes as opposed to the ability to litigate.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason behind that is in arbitration, you can't bring a class action lawsuit. And so especially these companies that have really large workforces, they don't want sort of an error or omission where, you know, maybe they're not dealing with tips the right way,
right,
to give rise to sort of a class action lawsuit and the attorney's fees associated with that. And so, you know, that's something where buyers have gotten very sensitive to looking for arbitration agreements with employments, with employees.
And if those things don't exist, are you usually pushing to get those in place at that point?
Yeah, the question kind of becomes, can this be a pre-closing condition that the existing employer puts in place? If you've got a stock deal, for sure. If you've got an asset deal, then maybe it's going to be a condition to the hiring of all of these employees in connection with you taking over the business.
So
that's definitely something that we look at. And another thing, just kind of operationally, that we definitely look at, and this doesn't really have very much to do with employment issues necessarily, and it kind of gets back to financial diligence, but a really good thing, and something I recommend any business attorney doing on buy or sell side, is reviewing the financial statements for the target, especially if they're CPA prepared, if there's been some assurance work done, because reading those notes to the financial statements, there's oftentimes really good stuff that you may not have any other insight into. The notes will put comments in there about related party transactions.
Right.
Maybe you don't realize that this target is leasing its facility from an affiliate, and it's a way under market lease.
Yeah.
And as part of the deal, you're going to have to negotiate a new lease with that guy. And yeah, he's the seller, but maybe he wants to step that lease up to market rent.
Yeah.
And now, again, your picture of how you're going to be operating this business post-closing has changed. Or other times we'll see provisions in there where they've got, a reserve for litigation, and you didn't have any other sort of knowledge of the litigation, but you see it in the financial statement notes.
Yeah.
So those are oftentimes sort of a gold mine to kind of just understanding what's out there, what you should be looking at in diligence, and just be understanding how the business works.
And is that where the related parties issue is an interesting one? And is that where you're typically finding out the information about those related party transactions? Because it's got to be difficult, right? You get a contract, you see ABC company on one side and XYZ Inc. on the other side, and you don't know that they're somehow related parties.
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing why. One reason why, you have these really broad diligence lists, because one of the things, in the contract section is any contracts with related parties.
Yeah.
And so in some respects, you're trying to kind of push this off onto the seller to identify them for you. But at the end of the day, if you don't uncover it, that's not really a good scenario. So having a target that has had assurance work done, where the accountants have kind of already pre-done the diligence for you in some respects, is a really good thing.
Yeah. Kind of, there's some efficiency gain there. Transitioning into intellectual property, and we've touched on it a few times throughout and talking about legal and financial and even some of the employment related stuff. Intellectual property's got to be one of the places where it varies most significantly during due diligence, depending on what type of company it is, what product they sell, what service they sell.
Yeah, for sure.
Are there, beyond some of the things that we've talked about, we talked about trademarks, we talked about trade dress with the furniture story. Are there other places where you're spending a lot of your time during intellectual property due diligence?
Yeah. Verifying who the registered owner of all the IP that the target purports to own is important. We see time and again that the company's website, the domain name, is actually owned technically by some guy in the IT department because he created the GoDaddy account or whatever. And so we want to make sure that that guy's going to assign it, to the buyer or to the company. Before the deal happens. And then another thing that we really like to look at, if there's a software heavy company, is trying to figure out if there's any open source code that has been incorporated into that company's product.
Right.
And if there has, then we need to really kind of drill down on making sure that they've complied with the requirements of whatever open source license is out there. Because that's definitely no fun when you find out after the fact you've bought this business and you can't sell the software anymore because it's incorporated some open source pieces
problem.
And you've violated the license.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to ruin your day.
Yeah, for sure. Outside of the different places we've touched on, are there any sort of gotcha places during due diligence or things that come up that maybe fall outside of these broader categories of financial and legal and IP and operational and these different buckets? Are there things that come up that you see, maybe it's once, but ideally it's something that you've seen more than once that comes up outside of the norm?
Yeah, and this is something we haven't touched on, but something you should always do in connection with kind of a buy-side diligence effort is getting a UCC report run on the target, because you will invariably find old liens that yep. someone filed a continuation statement on, and it actually got paid off, but it never got released, and now you've got a lien on your assets. Or people forget that they've got some tiny revolver out there, or that they got a purchase money security interest on a piece of equipment that they're selling. And as the buyer, especially in an asset deal, you want those assets to be sold to you free and clear of any liens.
Yeah, sure.
And you want to make sure that, you know, all the lien holders are giving you payoff letters in connection with the deal and agreeing to release their liens and telling you how much needs to be paid. And you usually end up trying to kind of create a flow of funds at closing that specifically pays that discrete amount to that discrete lien holder right at closing. So that money never even really hits the seller's hands.
Yeah.
And so looking at that is something that you should definitely do, whether it's a stock deal or an asset deal. And you will sort of be forced to do that if you've got any kind of debt use sources.
Mm-hmm.
If the buyer is bringing in traditional debt or even mezz debt or some other kind of debt, that lender and its counsel are going to be laser focused on sort of what liens are involved in the assets. And then kind of the same token is if there's real estate involved in the transaction. There's a bunch of environmental diligence that's probably going to be going on. They may actually kind of get a phase one or phase two report done, depending on sort of the use of that real estate, that's, more important or less important. But then just doing title, having a title insurance company issue yep. a title policy and reviewing that and making sure that the title to the land is going to transfer the way that your client expects it to.
Is there a typical, and I assume it's obviously going to range from deal to deal, but is there a typical timeline for due diligence of what it usually runs?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning we sort of talked about exclusivity, and I think in most instances, buyers are getting, 60 to 90, maybe 120 days
mm-hmm.
Of exclusivity. And so usually from the point in time at which you've signed the letter of intent to the point in time at which you sign a definitive agreement or close a deal, and most deals these days are sort of simultaneous signings and closings,
yep.
you're usually in this range of, 90 days plus or minus maybe 30. And if you got something done in 60 days, that'd be really fast. If it took you more than 120, you'd be going somewhat slow. And so financial diligence is going to take up the first maybe, three-ish weeks,
yep.
About maybe 30 days. And then the rest of it is going to kind of be legal due diligence. And legal due diligence is often sort of ongoing up until you close the deal. Or, sometimes if you don't have a due diligence condition in a deferred closing, it's going to go up until you sign the deal.
Yeah. One thing I was just curious about that popped in my head is, are you guys performing any sort of due diligence on your own client that's the buyer throughout the process to make sure that they're not getting themselves into a situation where, based on what you see in due diligence with them, is a bad situation for them?
Is that something that you just let them ask the question? No, you never want to have an unhappy client, and it doesn't behoove you to just sort of put your head in the sand if you think there's sure. a problem there. And so we've definitely had situations where, and a lot of this kind of comes up to structure, where a client has come to us with an LOI. And we start going through it, and then we realize, oh shoot, the way you guys have set this up, because you are this type of entity for tax purposes, this tax efficiency you think you're going to get from doing the deal is just not
right.
going to work.
Yeah.
And so we have to say, look, you need to do this instead, or sorry, you just can't do what you'd like to do. We need to kind of revisit it and figure out kind of how this is going to work. So we certainly kind of focus on that type of stuff. When we're doing cross-border deals, there's a lot of that similar type of
sure.
structuring where, if you've got an outbound U.S. merger and you're working with Canadian Corp, there's just this whole host of rules that you've got to make sure, you've passed every single one of these hurdles for it to work. And if for some reason something kind of gets fouled up, you got to figure out another way to kind of go down the path.
Yeah.
So we definitely are kind of cognizant of sort of how our buyer is structured to make sure that the way that they want the deal to sort of work out post-closing is going to be feasible. Luckily, most of the time when we're working with a buyer, it's in some fashion or another kind of a special purpose entity.
Yep.
And so it's malleable, and we can kind of make it work the way we'd like it to work.
Yep.
In those situations where there's sort of an existing platform entity and we're doing an add-on, it sometimes gets more difficult.
Are the line, I don't know if I should say are the lines ever blurred, because I'm sure they're blurred, but between the legal advice you're giving and the, like, this is a bad business deal, and
sure.
And where what is your role in that situation?
Yeah, so, you know, we've had the unfortunate, luck to have pointed out to a client who thought that they were buying a deal at 3x on EBITDA, that they were really actually buying it at 8x because they weren't including the assumption of indebtedness that was going to be associated with the deal in the way they were pricing it. And all of a sudden, this screaming deal that they thought they were getting really was not kind of very good.
Yeah.
You know, everyone kind of hears about EBITDA multiples and sort of what's market.
Right.
And this client had come to us with, hey, I've got this LOI and I'm paying 3x and it's going to be an amazing, you know, buy. And when we started looking at it, we're like, well, you know, this isn't a cash-free, debt-free deal. You know, yes, you're paying sort of 3x in cash, but you're also assuming all this indebtedness that's
right.
in place. And so on an enterprise value basis, you know, you're really not doing that. And that really kind of burst the client's bubble. But I think it saved them some blushes as well, because they ended up kind of being able to reprice and kind of, you know, back out of that situation that otherwise would have been, you know, pretty bad for them.
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to transition a little bit, as you know, in talking with us on the last episode we talked, we like to talk about practice management a little bit at the end. And,
sure.
The thing I'm curious about is when it comes to communication with clients,
mm-hmm.
is there a format for communication that you prefer? So email,
yeah.
Phone calls, texts. I know that's a newer thing that a lot of clients are pushing for. Just curious in your practice, what's the place you prefer?
My preference, and maybe this is just my nature as an attorney, is to communicate in writing via email.
Yep.
I think that email is a really good medium to be able to kind of lay out what are often kind of complex answers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that folks like to text, but it is really a very kind of casual medium.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get texts from clients oftentimes that I don't respond to
yeah.
via text, but I respond to via email. And, you know, you kind of have this urge in texts to kind of, you know, limit your response to 140 characters or less. And legal answers usually aren't that
yeah.
Simple. And so, you know, if I do get texts and it's, you know, something other than, hey, can we do a call? I usually try to kind of follow up an email
yeah.
and provide an answer that way. Obviously, spend a lot of time talking on the phone.
Yep.
The only thing that is sort of not helpful with phone conversations, and this is more just about a practice efficiency kind of component, is it's so much easier to reference an email you sent or an email conversation
yep.
You know, 3 months down the road than it is to remember sort of what you said on a phone call or what a client said on a phone call, or try to find your notes for that phone call.
Yeah.
You know, at least, you know, I personally take, you know, my notes still on a legal pad
right.
and, you know, flipping back, you know, 40 pages to something that happened, you know, a month or two ago to try to figure out what was said, is a lot more cumbersome than just searching in an email, for some key terms. And
do you usually follow up those phone calls with an email? It's like, hey, just to summarize what we talked about. So
yeah,
then you
it
have
sort of depends.
Reference point.
It kind of depends on the conversation, but we certainly, will send follow-up emails, especially if, you know, major business decisions were made. You know, we'll send an email and just say, hey, you know, we had this conversation, just want to follow up, and we're going to go ahead and do this.
Yeah.
You know, per your instructions, you
yeah.
know, it sort of depends.
I assume it kind of
depends.
Yeah.
On the,
yeah.
On
it depends on the client. If it's a client where you're like, look, I know they miss things in interpretation
sure.
on the phone call.
Yeah.
Then yeah, you'd probably follow up in writing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Cool. Outside of practicing law, I know you're into board games. You're developing
yep.
your own board game.
Yep.
Have developed your own board game.
Still
do you have
working
any,
on it.
Yeah. Do you have any? It's still a work in progress.
I mean, it'll probably be a work in progress for a really long time.
For your whole life.
Well, not that long.
Version 3, version 4. Are there any board games besides your own that you're
yeah.
developing that you recommend?
I've been playing a lot of Gloomhaven.
Okay. Tell me about
which
that.
Which is a pretty fun kind of campaign strategy game.
Yeah.
It's cooperative, so all of the players are sort of on a team, and they're sort of playing against, you know, AI characters effectively. And even though it's, you know, a board game and it's hard copy, there is sort of a monster AI. They sort of operate pursuant to certain rules. I think that game does a really good job of combining sort of story and game mechanics
yeah.
In a pretty interesting way. And then I just recently picked up a copy of Thornwatch. Okay. I'm excited to play that game. One of our clients, Penny Arcade, sort of developed that.
Yeah.
Or at least kind of created the concept, and then Loan Shark Games developed the game. And I was at their charity auction earlier this week and picked a copy up.
Awesome. So I'm probably Have you had a chance to play it?
No, I haven't. No. I just bought it on...
You took the couple hours that you could have played this game and decided to sit down and talk with us, right?
For sure. Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. What is it about board games? Like, what do you like about board games? How'd you get into
it? I just grew up playing board games, and, you know, I played, like, Risk with my dad and Stratego with my dad and, you know, Monopoly as a family.
Sure.
And I'm pretty, you know, having played soccer with you, I'm a relatively competitive person. Yeah. You might know this. And so board games are kind of a fun way to kind of be competitive but be friends at the end of the day.
Yeah, for
sure. My wife doesn't think that. She
Well, it's interesting you're into these cooperative games, too, then.
Yeah, that's actually one thing that I sort of like now is there's more cooperative games. You know, growing up, all of these things were sort of zero-sum games, and there's a winner and a loser. And, you know, for certain people that's fun, and others it's less fun. But now cooperative games are a lot more common, and so you sort of win or lose as a team, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it seems like in the last, especially like 5 to 10 years, they've kind of blown up. There's like the, you know, the huge blow-up in Settlers and...
Yeah, I think board games have sort of had a resurgence in the last decade for sure.
Yeah, which is cool to see, especially in this day and age with technology and like always.
Yeah, there's something to be said to have screens, you know, tactile kind of experience
And to sit like with people in one place and talk. You know, like there's something to that. That's
kind of the appeal.
Yeah, for sure. It's
I play Pandemic a bunch.
Yeah, like that's a fun game.
Yeah, awesome.
Yep.
Cool. Well, that's all the time we have. Steve, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate it. If you haven't gone and checked out the first episode, we talked with Steve on deal documents and business acquisitions. Check it out. And thanks for joining us.